Jacoby.
Here.
Mateo.
Here.
Kaplan.
Here.
Parker.
Here.
Sawyer.
Here.
And Goebel.
Here.
Okay, Spencer.
Nope, there we go. Thank you. So we'll be doing a presentation on the Oregon Department of Aviation statewide rates. That'll be about a 15-minute presentation. Secondly, we're going to have a presentation on building safety code enforcement. We've allowed 25 minutes for that. The third thing then is an executive session that we will schedule at the end of this meeting, and we've allowed 45 minutes for that, and then we'll have a urban renewal meeting that will start at 5:30. And so that's the schedule for today. So and so at this point, turn it over to Lance for presentation. Yeah, it is in the packet. Okay. Yep. And so Lance, why don't you go ahead?
All right. Is this working?
Hello. Oh, okay. Don't press it. Thank you for having me for this work session. We got 15 minutes to kind of go over this presentation. I don't have any slides or anything like that. The thing that I handed out earlier was an executive summary. Peggy had it uploaded to the packet. I wasn't sure if it got uploaded or not. Thank you, Peggy, for uploading that. So there is no single approach way for an airport for setting rates. The sponsor is flexible in setting the fees as long as there is some setting methodology used to apply consistently to similar situations and users. Currently, the ODA classifies Newport Municipal as a Category 2 urban general aviation airport, defined as supports all general aviation aircraft and accommodate corporate aviation activity, including piston and turbine engine aircraft, business jets, helicopters, gliders, and GA activity. The most demanding user requirements are business related. These airports service a large multi-state geographic region or experience high levels of general activity and have a minimum length of 5,000 feet for the runway. So Newport is one of 11 that fall into the category 2 urban general aviation. We are in that category with Astoria, Aurora, Bend Municipal, Corvallis, McMinnville, Portland Downtown Heliport, which is a helicopter pad, Portland Hillsboro, Portland Troutdale, Salem, and Scappoose round out the list for Category 2. On the staff reports on the back of the second page, you can see the upper graph is what all of the state, the people, the airports that responded are on the average. And I broke out what the current rate is for O&P. There's the typical fee range, and then the lowest to highest fee. And then below that, the next one down, this is where we line up with the other 11 airports that are in the Category 2, the current rate for O&P, the average, the highest. Also in the packet, there was two different documents added, 69 pages each. One was the survey analysis from the Oregon Department of Aviation, about 69 pages. And then, of course, there was a much larger survey for airports charge different types of fees for everything else that were added into that. So currently, where airports across the state are, just as like a fuel flowage fee, and that is where you have a private vendor coming onto the airport with their own fuel truck, and then they're pumping into their own aircraft, like Columbia Aeronautical will do that periodically. So the average on that is 5 cents, or the lowest is 5 cents per gallon, the highest is 35 cents per gallon, and we're currently at 15 cents. hangar ground lease for non-commercial square footage per year. This would be like your box hangars and executive hangars, privately built hangars. Or the lowest was 0.01722, and the highest was $1.68 per square foot. A typical range is 11 cents to 49 cents per square foot, and currently O&P is at 2.53 per square foot. We do have in the leases a CPI rate adjustment that goes up depending on the index each year. So hangar ground lease for commercial square footage per year. This would be like if Columbia or Life Flight wants to build a hangar, they'd be considered a commercial tenant. This is what the rates would be for that. Of course, there's the high and the low, and then the typical range fee is anywhere from 10 cents a square foot to 58 cents a square foot, and they're currently at O&P, it's 17 cents a square foot. The next line down is the developed hangar per month, and those range from $75 to $4,700. Typical range is anywhere from $110 up to $750. And then currently at Newport, it says $190, but we'll be raising that to $200 coming up in July for the current fee schedule that we have, which I also did include in the packet is the current fie schedule as well. So tie down and single, the tie down spots range anywhere from $3 to $20. And then the typical range fee is $3 to $20, and at O&P, we're currently at $5 a day or $40 a month. And that's how we compare with all of the airports in Oregon. And then the list below is how we compare with the 11 in the category two. Did you want me to go through the list, or are there any questions on anything so far? Yes, Cynthia.
My question is, do you know how our waiting list for hangars compares with these other airports in the state? Is everybody waiting to get in?
I don't know what the waiting list would be for other airports. I don't know what the availability is for other airports and stuff. I do know that our list is currently at 22.
And how many people are waiting? That's 22, or what does the 22 mean?
22 means the number of people that have put their name on our waiting list who are wanting a hangar.
Okay.
Or hangar right. Space, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and how many are we going to have available, say, in the next couple years?
Well, that's something that we've been
like
working on.
8 or 10 or something to add
what's
on?
What's normal turnover?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of interesting because we only have the 10 T hangers that we control through rent. Turnover on that is very, very, very slow. But once we get turnover, I would say probably every, 3 to 4 years, people all of a sudden 6 will come up. And it just varies, and that's what I've noticed since being here. I do have a gentleman that, or actually a couple of people that have been interested in developing that T-hanger spot behind the current T-hanger location. Of course, that would be done privately, and then that would have to go through, approval and stuff like that, too. They're just penciling out if it's going to work out. Also, some of the executive hangers and the box hanger people do open up their box hangers when they're not using it for people to, basically, they sublease to them and stuff. So it varies. It depends on what I have available. It's very limited from a city standpoint, but from the private sector up there, there is a little bit more availability.
It seems like if there's that much demand for hangar space, our prices are pretty low. And I think of when I'm renting a storage unit, 10 by 20 storage unit, I have to pay over $200 a month for that storage unit. It'd be cheaper for me to rent a hangar and store my stuff out there.
Hey, if you have an aircraft.
Yeah. The rates here are for the land only.
This is $190 for
the T-hangers
per month.
Oh. On the bottom portion, to answer your question, Councilor Goebel, is that the developed hangars at the other airports are anywhere from $167 to $405 a month. The average is $254 for the 7 that reported, and ours is moving up to $200. So They're in that range between 167 and 405 compared to the other 11 airports. But that also depends on the style and the type of hangar space available. Some of those hangars could be heated. Some of them could be just little, you know, like a carport type thing, or, you know, that doesn't have a door on it. So we really, I don't know what the other style of hangars are and what they are based off of. It could be also difference in sizes, like the one up at the top, the 4,700 a month. There's a giant hangar down in North Bend Coos Bay that goes for that monthly, but it's like 300 feet by 100 feet wide, and you can fit.
So what, how many hangars do we have that we rent out monthly?
Currently there are 10 T hangars. There are three spots in the FBO main hangar, which is one is with Life Flight, and then two other individual spots.
And they belong to the airport?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those spots in the main hangar go for $250 a month, just because we have to have the employees pull the aircraft in and out of the hangar for the tenants. Not the Life Flight helicopter, but the other two planes that are in there.
Okay. So you're going to raise it to 200 in June?
Yeah, for the July 1 increase, it'll be raised to 200.
That's what's before the budget committee in the fee schedule.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions for Lance?
Yeah.
Dan.
Do the rates cover the cost?
I guess as far as cost for what? Because the T hangars were built by the FAA AIP project. So the city had a 10% match on that. Uh-huh. And that built those T hangars and then three executive hangars. And then the main FBO hangar that was built privately as well, but then got turned over to the city. Well, the city purchased that. So as far as like cost wise, you know, I'm not really sure how that could compare. You know, like employee time to move the planes in and out, it definitely would, because they don't fly all that much, you know, but it's not going to pay, you know, the rent on the building or any of that other stuff. So I guess that depends on what you mean by cost and what you'd want to look into.
Mm-hmm. I think you're talking about maintenance and stuff.
Yeah.
How much does it cost us to maintain those hangars a year?
Well, I normally have it. Well, annually we have Salem Door Company, Overhead Door Company. They come out and look, make sure all the main doors are operating correctly. And that's about $3,000 to do that, because there's 10 doors they have to go through. And then anything that they might find that needs to be fixed or replaced, we can do that. But we don't put a lot of we don't need to put a lot of maintenance into that, because the building is you know, square building, no windows, so it cuts down. Yeah, eventually we will have to look at like roof repair and some other issues that are happening, because it is a metal building. It, you know, on the coast, it's rusting apart. But other than that, you know, there isn't a lot of maintenance other than, you know, the monthly fire alarm that's out there in each of the hangars, which is a code requirement and stuff like that.
Be so interesting to for us to have you give us an idea of what that costs, because we're only making $2,400 a year on those hangars, right?
No.
24,000.
No, we, yeah.
24,000 on the 10 T hangars, so.
Yeah, we currently have.
$200 a month, right?
Yeah, 200 a month, it's 2,000 a month.
No, $2,000 a month.
$200 a month times 10 is $2,000 a month times 12 is what the revenue is coming in from those T hangers.
But it doesn't cost us $3,000 for all the doors or for just one unit?
That's all the doors for them to come out and make sure that the lift motors are operating correctly and they're all lubed. Everything is, you know, to the correct tension
so
on the.
That's a combined cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's their annual inspection. And they, I mean, if they find some items that might need to be replaced, then that's kind of put in there based on, like, if it's a motor that needs to be replaced, it'd be a little bit higher than that, because you got to pay for the motor, of course. But we did do a report that is into the budget committee. Currently, we have 50 leases at the airport. And of those 50 leases, we make $168,000 a year.
Okay, we got to move forward. Beatrice, do you have a quick question?
Yes, I have a question. Do they have water, each one, or just general, like a one?
There's electricity that goes to the T hangers and to the individual box hangers and stuff. There is water, but only if the tenant wanted to tap into that. So they would have to call the city to set up a meter, and then they would pay for their own water that way.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you, Lance. We appreciate your report.
Excellent. Thank you all.
Thank you. And then next we have Derek and Joseph. And just because we're under a time crunch tonight, if you could kind of keep it to 4:40, that would be great.
Good afternoon. My name is Joseph Lees. I'm the building official for the city, and Derek has asked me to provide a presentation on our building code enforcement activities, so I've prepared a PowerPoint for you. Did you want to say anything?
No, why don't you go ahead and start the PowerPoint. Okay. I'll chime in.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to contrast the difference between the various departments. Here in the building division of community development, we just handle complaints about unpermitted construction and dangerous buildings and other building code violations. As compared to other departments or divisions, for example, our planning division, they handle the zoning permit process and all the various permits that entails. And they handle complaints about zoning violations. And then, of course, the police department, they handle a number of, they handle a lot of complaints, but particularly about public nuisances as identified in Chapter 8 of the Municipal Code. Abandoned vehicles, noise violations, sign violations, parking violations, business license, room tax compliance, and they're doing the enforcement on short-term rental violations. And fire department, they handle review of construction plans. They review our construction plans for fire access and water supply. They handle fire code violations and fire hazards, and they do fire safety inspections of various businesses. So I just wanted to focus on, in this presentation, on the building side of it. Oh, and I forgot to mention Public Works. I'm sorry. They have a fog program, which is intended to prevent the discharge of fats, oils, and greases into the city sewer system. They also have right-of-way permits, erosion. They handle erosion control complaints where erosion may get into the stormwater system, and they have a backflow prevention device maintenance program. Enforcement of city ordinances and codes provide for public safety with the intention of protecting health, life, and property, neighborhood preservation and livability, and intended to prevent the spread of blight. Building code enforcement, our enforcement in regards to complaints is primarily reactive. We don't actively go out and look for violations. We can at times come across violations and then we will cite them, but generally we're not actively looking for them. The type of complaints that we get are, number one is unpermitted construction, and The second most is dangerous buildings. And then a lot of miscellaneous violations of building codes. So our legal authorities stem from Oregon Revised Statute, Section 455.020, which provides us the enforcement authority to enforce statewide building codes, which provide minimum standards for construction and maintenance of buildings. So this provides legal enforcement authority to local jurisdictions. And building codes primarily are applicable to new construction, but each building has to comply with the code under which it was constructed. So generally, building codes are not retroactive. Newport Municipal Code adopts the Oregon building codes. And we also adopt the Uniform Code for the Abatement of Dangerous Buildings. You'll hear me say UCADB, that's what I'm referring to, and that's in Muni Code Section 1105.080. So from all outward appearances, the structure you see on the screen here is a dangerous building. You see, even a layperson would see severe structural collapse and failure of structural systems. But one thing I want to point out with this slide is a lot of times the determination of a dangerous building is situational. You might have two buildings that have the same defects, and one might be deemed a dangerous building, the other might not. For example, in this photo, if you had this, you know, 2 miles outside of town on a private road, it might not be deemed a dangerous building because it's dependent on Section 302, which says, to the extent that life, health, property, or safety of the public or its occupants are endangered. So in this case, this building is not obviously occupied. It's in an isolated area. It may not be deemed a dangerous building. And you see across the Oregon landscape, you see a lot of old barns and things that are kind of in this situation that jurisdictions generally ignore until there's a problem with it. So I just want to point that out. The process, generally it starts with a complaint from neighbors or tenants or concerned citizens. Results in investigation, so we will research the building records. We have building records going back to about the early 60s, and the county assessors has some records that we rely on. We'll do an investigation, we'll talk to the owner, talk to any contractors involved in order to determine if there is a violation. So once we've determined that there is a violation, we'll issue a notice and order as provided for by the UCADB, basically providing legal notice to the owner of the property of the conditions that constitute a dangerous building, or in the case of unpermitted construction, what exactly requires a permit that they're doing. If we fail to get compliance with a notice and order, generally we send out a second notice and order, but after that we could seek administrative citation through the police department, and there's fines associated with that. Then other possible remedies we don't use a lot because we've been pretty successful in gaining compliance. But other things that are available to the city are abatement agreements, wherein we basically work with the owner to find a resolution and we enter into some kind of formal or informal agreement with them. If you get into court action, of course, there's a temporary restraining order that you could get. Everything after this pretty much court action, criminal or civil complaint. Administrative hearings and abatements. We don't have an active administrative hearing body to hear these cases. We really haven't had a great need for it. And of course, the city could whether pre-deprivation hearing, either through a court or through administrative body, obtain an abatement warrant and actually undertake an abatement. There's also liens for incurred costs that you could impose for staff time, any other costs associated with an abatement. There's also a lease pendants process or a notice of pendency, wherein you would file a notice with county recorder that would, in effect, notify any potential buyers that there's a pending action against the property. We've never used that, to my knowledge, here. But those provisions are provided for in the UCADB. And, of course, there's receivership, which would be through a court order. We've done that at least once since I've been here to effect a demolition. Status of cases investigated over about the last 4 years plus. Unpermitted construction, we've had about 67 cases, 41 in which we issued notices complied. We have 6 that are pending, and 20 investigations resulted in no violation noted. Dangerous buildings, we had 19 cases over the course of those 4+ years where we issued notices, 11 complied. We have currently 3 pending cases and 5 investigation in response to the complaint resulted in no violation noted. Miscellaneous violations, we had 25. We issued notices on 17 and they all complied, and we had 8 investigations that resulted in no violations.
Could you speak to what fits in the miscellaneous category?
It could be a number of things. For example, if someone's using, we had one down here on South Coast Highway where they were using a commercial building for residential occupancy, which wasn't authorized. And there was a lot of electrical violations, and that was vacated. Other things we've had 4 or 5 restaurants where they were cooking without the requisite kitchen equipment, hood, and fire suppression. Usually that gets reported to us by the fire department. Just different things related to building codes that where they're not in compliance. A recent example, 5909 Rhododendron. This building was in a state of structural collapse due to a land fissure that went right through the building. If you're familiar with the area, you know the big hump across 60th Street there. Well, it went right through this building.
Good deal.
And it was in a state of disrepair for about 2 or 3 years.
And what about the buildings to the west of them? I noticed there was one building boarded up. Has that one been abandoned?
Which building is that?
West, directly west of this one.
There's one, kind of southwest.
Yeah,
where they have the leaning garage.
That one is that the one you're talking about? Too? Yeah.
It's a manufactured home. Yeah, it's been vacated. The owner plans on demolishing it. Yeah, we have a compliance agreement with the owner on that one. So there you can see a crack through the front porch, went all the way through the house. Basically, the house was separating about in the middle and pulling apart. It's hard to see in the picture, but that fissure goes right through the house and
still occupied.
There's really no saving it.
I'm sorry. Is it still occupied?
No, it was vacant. It was vacant. So that one's been demolished, the one on 5909 Rhododendron. This one's at 837, 839 Southwest Bay Boulevard, formerly Sea Dogs Restaurant and a cannabis shop. And back in January or December, we had some king tides that damaged a severely deteriorated wharf underneath, and the building started collapsing. And this was actually reported by the tenant. There you can see the floor. It's separated from the walls about 4 to 5 inches. Due to these pilings underneath, the deterioration there you can see in the pilings. This is still pending. It's been vacated and fenced off so the public can't access it. And we're working with the current owners. I think originally they were saying they wanted to reconstruct it. I think now I've heard it's been put on the market for sale. So this building, 769 Southwest Bay, has severe structural deterioration. And there you can see some damage to the beam seats at the wharf. And you see here the wall separating, so it's actually subsiding there. And those interior beams, they have them shored up there, but they had significant deflection in them. So this building, three quarters of it's been demolished, and that last quarter was rehabilitated. It was actually under two different ownerships. So one owner elected to keep the single-story portion and rehabilitate it.
So that was all done at private expense?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Good.
And I can field any questions if you have any.
I have one, if that's right. So a lot of those categories the violation was reported to the city, and then you went and investigated and found there wasn't a violation. So is there a common theme to that? Is it perception of the public as to what is and isn't a violation creates that bulk of those non-issues, or what is the reason, do you think?
So in the case of unpermitted construction, you know there's a list in Section 105 of the Building and Residential Codes that provides exemptions. For example, you can have a 200-square-foot patio attached to a structure that doesn't require a permit.
Oh, like a patio that's nailed to the structure?
Yep.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so if it's less than 200 square feet or a porch, it's exempt. Non-habitable accessory structures less than 200 square feet are exempt. So a lot of those non-violations were things that were basically exempt.
Okay.
You can replace siding and windows without permits. Things like that. So on the unpermitted side, that was the majority of them. On the dangerous building side, a lot of them didn't rise to the level of being classified as a dangerous building. Although they may have some structural defects, they weren't to the point they were endangering health or life. And those are generally referred to police department because of the dilapidated nature.
Can I ask a follow-up question on that? That's really interesting, but so where is the line crossed between order not to occupy versus a dangerous building? Is that the same process? If a building's considered dangerous, that means they post the front that says no entry, or are those two separate processes?
Well, there's different processes for emergencies. If you recall, a few years back, we had a landslide out on 70th Street.
Right.
So,
Longview Hills.
Yeah, our response to that was based on the landslide, and I think there were five or six structures that were red tagged and given notice, and we had a hearing and what have you. So that's one process. Say if we had an earthquake, we'd do a lot of that.
Right.
Kind of a disaster response, damage assessment. But on the dangerous building side, if we think we can make the case, and of course the burden is on the city to prove such a case,
right,
that it's a dangerous building, if we think we can make the case, then we would issue a notice. And if we think it's just more on the nature of cosmetic dilapidation, then police department would handle that as a public nuisance.
Right. And just on that issue too, we've had this discussion at work sessions in the past. We don't have a public maintenance code, you know, dealing with things like painting and deteriorated trim and things that are more aesthetic in nature. And council has not wanted to move in that direction in the past. And I think you get a lot of calls, or you get some calls of that nature, which really we don't have authority either in building or in the police department to deal with some of those types of circumstances.
A lot of them look pretty bad because they're very dilapidated, a lot of deferred maintenance. But structurally, they're not at risk of collapse. Or...
Okay, Beatrice?
I think, Spencer, I kind of touched a little bit. When a building is unsafe, they get the sign, right? They get something like a don't trespass or something like that. And how about neighbors that live close by? Do they get information about it?
No, under the dangerous buildings code, we're not required to notify neighbors. But I mean, if it was a situation where you had a building that had the potential to collapse on a neighboring building, certainly we would probably post both buildings if it was that bad. Usually it's not that case, because a lot of the buildings we're dealing with are single story. So a collapse is not gonna affect the neighbors. But if it did, then we would have to deal with that potential too.
I think it's important, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And thank you for the slides, they are really good.
Okay.
Cynthia.
Who deals with, say for instance, a tree that's about to fall on somebody else's house? Is that a police?
Well, I don't know who deals with trees. On private property, I think.
Mike Cavanaugh, maybe? I don't know.
I think it would just be a civil matter.
Matter if the tree's on private property. If it's in a public right-of-way and it's putting private property at risk, we have proactively, through Public Works, taken care of it.
Still the property owner's responsibility adjacent to that right-of-way, so.
Right, and we have a number of property owners that act, but we have, as kind of a fail-safe, taking care of it in circumstances where the tree's in a right-of-way.
Ryan. I have another question. This is a long simmering one that's been in my craw. So how would you characterize the land that's owned by 13 investors? Would you say that's a nuisance, or is that not in the code as it stands currently?
The ownership?
The lack of maintenance on the disturbed site, it's just a huge...
This is the investor's
acreage 12. Of Scott's Broom that is a public nuisance, in my opinion, for any allergy sufferer that lives south of the bridge. It's been like that for years, and no action has been taken, so I just wondered, is that sort of a code... is there any code compliance issue there, or is it just a hole in the code, or can we ask them to better manage it? Because OMSI has managed theirs at their own expense.
To the extent that it's a compliance issue, it would fall under the nuisance code in terms of not maintaining property and creating a fire hazard. We typically rely on the fire department, though, to advise those circumstances where the lack of maintenance of an undeveloped property is such that it's a fire risk.
So it's up to the fire marshal to deem it a violation before they'd pursue anything, is that right, as it stands now?
You know, that's how we typically have approached. That's not the only property where we've had, you know, complaints, for example, come in that it's not being maintained and it's unsightly, and it's the fire risk provision principally that we lean on.
Any resolution suggestions on that?
I think the right now Scotch Broom, you know, we don't have a specific code provision to regulate specific species of plants being on private property, and we have a lot of Scotch Broom on a lot of properties in the community. So I think again, we had some discussion about outreach to the property owner and seeing if they'd be willing to cut the Scotch Broom on the property on a voluntary basis, and I don't know if that discussion ever has been had with them or not. Do you know, Derek, because they've been, you know, I think we've had some recent discussions with them, and that's certainly something we can share with them.
Oh, yeah, we certainly can. They're positioning the property for development right now. So they're, and that's certainly, you know, if they move forward with their development plans, it's going to address that at least somewhat. I don't know that they plan to develop the entire property. I think right now they're looking at the north half. So they're working on a partition to kind of set that up. I can reach out to them, see, you know, kind of where they're at and what they might be willing to do.
Voluntary compliance would be the quickest way to try to resolve it. So.
Sure. Well, I agree that voluntary compliance is the best methodology, but it opens up the issue. I'm happy to support some sort of code addition talking about fire risk, regardless of species of plant. The issue is, it's a visibility issue, it's a blight issue, even though the code may not say that specifically. Right. And it's a neighbor issue, right? I mean, if land is cleared for development, maybe the coordination could improve between, you know, instead of just letting it be a seed bed for 20 years. There are other parts of town where these invasive plants and shrubs have created a significant amount of fire risk, and that's my main concern, is that it provides, you know, windage and fuel for a fire that's going that way in the prevailing winds in the driest time of the year. And so that's where I'd like to see something in the code talking about unmanaged vegetation and what triggers, I mean, ideally, do the right thing isn't necessarily a municipal tool, but an outreach letter that could be sent to any property owner anywhere in the city with some tips and access to grant money outside of city funds, I could help work on that if that's what gets us to where we need to be.
Yeah, I think, okay, if you could wrap it up real quick, we're
yeah, behind. I can answer Ryan's question right now real easily. 8.10.060 under the nuisance code, that's related to vegetation and vision obstructions. Section A says this, it lists a few invasive species, and it says other noxious vegetation greater than 8 inches in height or that are a fire hazard. That's a nuisance. The city shall have discretion to not enforce this section based on the totality of circumstances, including the type and location of the property, whether the property is appropriately left in a natural state, has ever been cleared, so forth. So, as Derek noted, there is a provision in the nuisance code that speaks about what you were talking about, Ryan, that could be a fire hazard, and the discretion is, does it need to be abated or not based on the totality of the circumstances?
Well, I think that specific provision sounds like I'd like to see a copy of that communication when it occurs.
We have to move on. I think this is definitely a subject we needed to further explore going forward. And could I get a motion to go into executive session?
Yeah, just to finish that up too, we can see if we can pull together a report on what steps could be taken on that, because it affects a lot of land in the community.
That's what I mean.
Right.
So, the scale matters, yeah? But that was the example that everyone understands, which is right. Why I brought that example up.
Okay, could I get a motion for executive session?
I move to go into executive session pursuant to ORS 192.660, subsection 2, subsection D and E, to discuss labor negotiations and real property transactions.
Thank you, Joseph, for coming.
Okay, yeah, thank you, Derek, you and Joseph. Okay, we have a motion by Councillor Goble, seconded by Councillor Kaplan. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, we will now go into conference room A for executive session, and Piggy will have to switch some stuff over.
Ryan, I'll send you the provisions so you can look at it.
Yeah.
I read it quickly because you can get it.
Can you send the tool?
Can I do it pretty fast? Look at
what burns, making up fire.
I'll send it to
you. Can you send the tool?
Just covers me.
What's that?